difficult to imagine Indians on Cape Ann, because over the past 350 years, we've been told that there were no Indians on Cape Ann, that they had all become extinct through disease and warfare by the time the English settled here. This story was perpetrated by early town historians, and it was very well developed by 1830 and was used to justify Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy, in which all of the surviving eastern groups were moved west of the Mississippi River to less desirable or marginal land. Building on that precedent, the same story has been told over and over again and is still told today. If you ask an archivist in Gloucester or in Ipswich, they will tell you there were no Indians here. And it's not true. It is not true. And that's been one of the things I've found out in my research that I'm sharing. First of all, there's a ton of archaeological evidence for the occupation of Cape Ann from at least the Middle Archaic period, and that covers at least the last 8,000 years. It dates to the embayment of all the rivers and the formation of the salt marshes and the barrier beaches, which is what brought people here. That's what brought the coastal maritime Archaic people here. And tons of material has been removed, and it's in far-flung museums and private collections, which I've been documenting. But the artifacts and the sites and the landscapes documented for Cape Ann are not publicized. There are no exhibits, except a very small one at the Cape Ann Museum. There's no curricula for the students. The students are taught about the Wampanoags instead. They did not even speak the same language as the Indians who lived here on Cape Ann. And there are no plaques for the native horticultural settlements known to have existed in Riverview, Wingersheek, Lobster Cove in Annisquam, at Old Garden Beach, Stage Fort Park, and other places like some of the islands on Essex Bay. And there's no mention locally of the very active seasonal procurement camps that they had on Little River and in Goose Cove, Lane's Cove, Pigeon Cove, all around the coastline. The website for the Crane Estate in Ipswich does not mention that Castle Hill was the principal fort of Masconomet. It doesn't mention any native precedent there. And the websites for Agassiz Rock and Red Rock and the other rocks in the conservation areas don't mention that they were Native American installations and or sacred sites in a Native American landscape. Why don't we know about these things? Because that was my question. That was what got me started on this. Why don't we know about this? I was stunned. Amazed. And what are we showing here? These are just some of the places where artifacts have been collected on Cape Ann. Whoops. Now, the archaeologists and the collectors have been working here since shortly after the Civil War up to the present day. But in the present day, we have what are called cultural resource management projects. They tend to be privately funded, and they're not publicized. There's a wealth of material that has been brought up here since 2000 that we don't know. We even have radiocarbon dates for early and middle woodland sites on Cape Ann, but we don't know about them. Partly because they're privately funded and partly because the Massachusetts Historical Commission is concerned about sites being looted or desecrated, and so are the Indian councils concerned about that, and it's a legitimate concern. But there has to be a balance between protection and public education, because we should know about these things. That's my contention in any case. This is the location of some of the finds on Cape Ann. The key refers to some of the professional and avocational archaeologists who made key discoveries prior to 1970. For example, Marshall and Foster Saville, who grew up in Rockport, Frank Speck, who summered in Riverview, and his student, Frederick Johnson. Johnson became a very famous archaeologist and, for example, dug up the Boston Fish Weir. N. Carlton Phillips of Gloucester, and others more contemporary, such as Robert Matz at Wingersheek, still living. And there are many other sites besides on the Essex and Ipswich Rivers, at Chebacco Lake, in Essex Bay, and so on. in the towns carved out of Ipswich and Old Newbury. Now, these are a few of the artifacts found on Cape Ann, representing as much as 10,000 years of archaic and woodland technologies. And they're the subjects of other talks that I give. These are part of the Saville collection, and they're in the Sandy Bay Historical Society. These are part of the Phillips collection, which is stored in the Cape Ann Museum in Gloucester. These are part of a private collection of Tom Ellis, who's the skipper of the Lannan. He has quite a large collection from Coles Island and Hog Island. These artifacts from Cape Ann are in the Museum of the Annisquam Historical Society. These are in the Manchester Historical Society. These are just a small sample. These are in a large collection that's in the Ipswich Museum. The curator of the Ipswich Museum assured me that there were no Indians on Cape Ann. This is the Robbins Museum in Middleborough, which is the headquarters of the Massachusetts Archaeological Society, and they store artifacts from Cape Ann in its Chadwick collection. The Essex Shipbuilding Museum, the Peabody Essex Museum, and the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology in Cambridge also have collections. So this is really only a tiny sample. For example,
this shows there were Indians, but it doesn't show they were here after 1600, right?
Well, I'm coming to that. These are in Harvard's huge collection of artifacts and grave goods from Ipswich, Essex, and Gloucester. It includes the famous Annisquam effigy, which is actually a 20-centimeter sandstone carving on the right of a woman with an Abnaki headdress with a papoose on her back that was dug up in Lobster Cove in Annisquam. Every school child in Gloucester should see this and know about it. The necklace and bracelet on the left were grave goods taken from a grave in Annisquam. Annisquam was the burial ground for the people who lived here. New England prehistory is divided into these four periods, and each period has an early, middle, and late phase. Direct evidence for the Paleo-Indians we don't get here because our Paleo-Indian sites are underwater. The nearest one is in Ipswich at Bulbrook, although the Annisquam Museum does have one artifact that I believe is Paleo-Indian. It's just that it's not clear where that artifact came from, whether it came from Cape Ann or somewhere else. Let me just go back here. Our images of Indians, our stereotypes of the Indians, tend to be based on the Paleo-Indians who were, you know, maybe hunting mastodons and caribou with spears in Ipswich or something, or the other stereotype is of the Eastern Woodland Indians that were here when the English made contact or the French made contact. But these are only the first and the last of the people who lived here, many different groups of people who lived here over several millennia. And so the people who were here when the Europeans made contact were the Pawtucket. That's one name for them anyway. We have ethnographic and documentary evidence of the Pawtucket here. They were not Massachusetts, they were not Wampanoag. They were Abnaki speaking. They were from New Hampshire. They were a branch of the Penacook who had homelands in the Merrimack Valley. And until the late woodland period, the Pawtucket migrated seasonally between their winter village, Wamisit in Lowell, and the coast. Agawam was the name of their principal village in Ipswich, which translates from Abnaki as other side of the marsh. And their ancient name for their principal village on Cape Ann, which was in Riverview, was Wenasquawam, which translates as end of the marsh. And the name of the village and its river from which we get the word Annisquam is attested in an ancient manuscript that is in the British Archives in London. The colonists called them the Agawam or the Pawtucket or the Wamisit, depending on where they were when they met them, but they were all the same people. At their winter village of Wamisit in Lowell, they fished at Pawtucket Falls on the Merrimack, and every summer they came to the Essex County coast to farm and to fish. Now, the distance between their coastal villages and their winter village is only about 30 miles, only a day trip. And as seasonal migrants between defined points within a small defined area, they were not nomads. They were not wanderers, which is another part of the myth. When a squawam was part of Agawam, Agawam extended from Newburyport to Cape Ann. It included Hamilton Wenham, it included Boxford, and there was Nomkeag. Nomkeag, or Nahumkeki, included Beverly, Salem, Danvers, Middleton, and Peabody. And there's still a large representation of Native Americans to this day in that area. At the time of English contact, all of this entire area was included in Maskinomet's Sagamoreship. It was not a tribe. It was a collection of related bands, and Maskinomet was the hereditary leader of this aggregation of bands of interrelated families. So these people did not have a corporate identity the way a tribe does or a nation. They had a different type of social organization. Maskinomet's given Pawtucket name was Quanopkanot. We should know this. He acquired the name Masquanamoyet from the Nipmuc, to whom he was related through marriage. It's an honorific name, and it translates, as far as I can determine, as he who something a black bear. And I don't know what he did to the black bear, but he did something to the black bear. It's he who something a black bear. I think it has something to do with he who single-handedly or by hand did something to the black bear. It was traditional for people's names to change over their lives as their lives unfolded. Massasoit's given name, for example, was Usamequin. As you can see, Masquanamoyet was spelled in various ways in the literature. It was shortened to Maskinomet or Maskinomo. He became known as Sagamore John after his conversion to Christianity around 1640. He received a Christian burial in 1658 and is buried on Sagamore Hill in Hamilton. His people co-resided with the English until around 1686, sometime after King Philip's War. We have other documentary evidence that Native Americans were here at the time of contact, first by the French in 1604, and then 20 years later by the English. Indirect contact was already taking place through the Basques and the Bretons, the fisheries on the Gulf of Maine, the French fur trade, the English and Dutch fisheries in Newfoundland. And this is Champlain's well-known map of Lurbeau Port in 1606. Ringed with wigwams, and it was when I saw this that I realized there's a wigwam in Cripple Cove, which is where I live, so what's the story? And my friend tells me it should be wickwams, not wigwams. So I try to say it right. The Indians, according to the legend, signaled Champlain's fleet with smoke signals from Emerson Point. It's impossible to know if that's true. Champlain is allegedly landed in Whale Cove, and the Indians guided him to Gloucester Harbor. He was looking for a good capital for New France, but he decided that Cape Ann was not the right place. There weren't enough fur animals here, and the natives were too happy to see him. Among other things, they wanted the guns that the French were giving out in trade to the Pawtucket's enemies to the north. Champlain's map shows a horticultural settlement. Do you see the corn they're growing? Each wigwam has a garden. And they were growing corn on Cape Ann on all the more or less level southwest facing land here, well before the time of European contact. This is some of the documentary evidence stemming from English contact between 1602 and 1686. when the Dorchester Company men abandoned their fishing post in Fisherman's Field at Stage Point in 1626 and went from Cape Ann to Namkeag or Beverly Salem with Roger Conant, they had Pawtucket guides. And their children later testified to friendly contact there. Letters from these principals show that the Dorchester Company was able to pay off the debt for its failed fishing venture, which was about 3,000 pounds British sterling, within 3 years through trade with the Indians of Cape Ann and Beverly Salem. Indians had to have been here for that to happen. There's also plenty of historical and anecdotal evidence, including court records, showing that Indians were here in some number during and after English settlement. And these are some of the events that are in the written record. So there's this odd double vision thing, or a split screen thing, where on the one hand there were no Indians, on the other hand we keep hearing about them and keep hearing about them. Now, King Philip's War of 1675-1676 changed everything. This King Philip was Metacomet, a son of Massasoit. He led the Wampanoags in a war against the English, in case you didn't know. After this war, the English came to regard all Indians as enemies, especially where fighting continued for another 100 years on all their frontiers. It was clear that the Indians could not have become extinct through disease or warfare prior to English settlement. Very little is said about Indians in town documents. And the last we hear of them in the 1680s, there have been incidents or threats of vigilantism against them, which is the last written record I have found from 1682. The deed that Masconomic's grandson, Samuel English, signs in 1701 is the last we officially hear from any Indians here. So where did the story of extinction come from? And how come we keep hearing about Indians when there weren't supposed to be any? And how come we don't hear about them in the 1700s? About the story where they died from disease. Essex County was not depopulated by disease, as is popularly claimed. William Bradford down in Plymouth wrote that 90 to 100% of the native people on the South Shore had, quote, miraculously, end of quote, died before the Mayflower landed in 1620. And John Winthrop in Boston declared that the Indians in eastern Massachusetts were extinct, which was not true. North of Boston, furthermore, the survival rate from the first epidemic was easily 50 to 75% or more, because the northern coastal people went inland at the first sign of disease, and they stayed in their winter villages above the falls on tidal rivers and were therefore largely spared. And the reason is because the first disease was a bacterial contamination of soil and water. It came from the urine of rats on the ballast stones that Europeans dumped at river mouths to make room for their cargoes of furs. It began in the maritime provinces at around 1611, spread unevenly down the coast, and ended by 1620 through acquired immunity. It was the smallpox epidemics that came later that caused so much problem and that took so many lives. The first one was in 1633, and it took English along with Indians, but Indians in much greater numbers. This is according to the Centers of Disease Control that the first disease was identified as leptospirosis. The contamination of fresh water and soil, the vessels were careened to dump ballast to make room for the cargo and to bream the hulls. I love that, careen and bream. Sounds like it should be in a poem. Cape Ann's tidal rivers, even the big Merrimack River, they're all barred. They have narrow, shallow channels. Transatlantic ships could not get up them. So the bacterial diseases were probably introduced later in this area at Little Good Harbor, maybe. Or maybe via Abenaki middlemen in the fur trade. Or maybe the colonists' hogs, contaminating the clam beds. In most areas north of Boston, leptospirosis did not cause anywhere near 90% mortality as claimed. Even if there had been 90% mortality here, there still could easily have been 300 people on Cape Ann the summer the Dorchester Company landed at Half Moon Beach. The Indians also had not been destroyed by generations of warfare with their enemies. The Mi'kmaq of New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia, who were collectively known as the Tarentines, and the Iroquois, especially the Mohawks or the Kanien'kehá:ka to their west. The Algonquians and the Iroquoians had a tradition of blood vengeance, but they did not engage in wars of conquest. At least 500 years prior to European contact, the hunter-gatherers of the north, the Tarentines, would every year sweep down the coast in canoes to raid the agricultural villages of the New England coast. Corn could not be grown above the 50th parallel. The growing season wasn't long enough. And so you had hunter-gatherers of the north coming down to raid the agriculturalists in the south. This went on before and independently of any contact with Europeans. The Iroquois wanted access to the Atlantic, where the fur trade was and where Europeans were with all their interesting gear, amazing and powerful gear. And the Algonquians of New England were in between these two enemy forces that went back easily 1,500 years prior to contact. But they didn't kill each other off, is what I'm suggesting here. So how did we get the idea that they were extinct? According to a whole lot of new scholarship, the story of extinction came from local historians, including ours. Most New England town histories and centennial addresses dismiss the subject of Indians, except in reference to deeds, uprisings, and laws. Obadiah Bruin's 1650 account of the founding of Gloucester and Babson's 1860 history of Gloucester don't even mention Indians at all. In other histories, if Indians are mentioned, it's to repeat these main points, which are part of the what is known as the erasure narrative. This is the story that is repeated, has been repeated generation after generation. Erasure as a process included renaming places and declaring groups legally disbanded. Changing the names of places helped to legitimate replacement. And present-day scholarship is showing why New Englanders sought to erase Native Americans from both memory and landscape, because then, as now, history is written by groups in power. Erasure began through censorship of speech. In 1637, after defeating the Pequot Indians in the Pequot War, the Massachusetts Bay Colony made it a crime to speak the name Pequot. You could be whipped and fined or imprisoned for uttering the word. The village of Pequot was renamed New London, Connecticut. And the Pequot River was renamed the Thames. The Pequot were massacred at Mystic by joint colonial forces led by John Mason. The few survivors were sold into slavery and the tribe was declared extinct. Today there are altogether about 2,000 Mashantucket and Eastern Pequot in Connecticut around Foxwoods and Stonington. The main form of erasure is this extinction narrative, the vanishing Indian, the last Indian, and most town histories written between 1830 and 1900 say the same things, that the history of New England begins with the English, who were the first to live here, the first to erect houses, the first to tame a vast unoccupied wilderness. Some early histories say the English attempted to help the wandering Aborigines to enter the modern age, such as 17th century Europe was modern, or how they had to subdue what was left of the Indians. This is the first Massachusetts seal, and the Indians' caption bubble reads, come over and help us. Now, implicit in the extinction narrative is the belief that permanent settlement, civilization based on Christianity and modernity, naturally and logically led to the displacement and then replacement of the Indians. It was the natural order of things. And the view that the extinction of Indians was a natural consequence became the basis of a wilderness narrative, which was expressed even into the 20th century. This is a 20th century writer, Spencer Trotter. He's writing about forests in the Northeast, and he's asserting that Indians could not possibly aspire to civilization or modernity because of their dependence on wilderness. Trotter even claimed that because Indians could not live apart from the wilderness, it was natural that they should disappear as the forests were cut down, just like any other forest fauna. This wilderness narrative was dehumanizing, and as we know from our own understanding of history, dehumanization is the first step in genocidal approach to an outgroup. As a natural imperative, it was the other side of the divine providence argument expressed by John Winthrop in the 1630s, that the demise of Indians was a result of divine intervention favoring their replacement by the godly English. And these are some of the processes or steps in the replacement process. Now, what kills me, or what killed me when I found out, the early archaeologists and ethnologists made this worse. They contributed to it and reflected these prevailing popular views. Archaeologists tended to dismiss New England sites as insignificant or uninteresting. They were only shell heaps, only burial grounds. They didn't show signs of permanent settlement and monumental architecture like the native civilizations of Mexico and Central America. And so they were inconsequential. And speakers at bicentennial celebrations in town after town could say authoritatively that other than particular individuals, famous sachems, or as we say, sachems, that Indians were essentially inconsequential. By 1900, it became popular to impersonate Indians on stage and in parades, to write romantic fiction harking back to the days when there were Indians. And after Indian removal, tribal identities were terminated and selectively restored only after massive legal efforts, which are ongoing. So, as the new scholarship of the erasure phenomenon shows, the English made history, they established the first permanent settlements, tamed the wilderness, practiced modernity, had a future, and were the first of their kind in a new world. Whereas the Indians made no history, were mere wanderers, disappeared naturally with the wilderness, were unable to become modern, had no future, and were the last of their kind in a doomed world. This is a very compelling scenario.
Makes you want to kill yourself.
Yeah, really. Now, Jean O'Brien coined the phrase firsting and lasting for historical texts that focus on firsts achieved by the English and that either celebrate or lament the last of the Indians. The subtitle of her book is Writing Indians Out of Existence in New England, from which I borrowed the title of my talk as well. Her book cover shows Pocahontas, known as Black Will. He's selling Nahant to Thomas Dexter for a suit of clothes in 1628, in which the Indian is already becoming invisible. These are some of the leading authors writing on the subject of erasure and Native American survival and resilience in the Northeast. And these are the sources I've consulted as part of my talk. And if anyone would like to receive my bibliography after this, just email me and I'll be glad to. I hate to read from slides, but I have to read this because this is an erasure narrative in D.F. Lamson's 1895 History of Manchester by the Sea. And it encapsulates the erasure narrative, which is repeated to this day. And he dismisses the Indians in this single opening paragraph. The history of America begins with the advent of Europeans in the New World. The red men in small and scattered bands roamed the stately forests and interminable prairies, hunted the bison and the deer, fished the lakes and streams, gathered around the council fire and danced the war dance. But they planted no states, founded no cities, established no manufactures, engaged in no commerce, cultivated no arts, built up no civilizations. They left their names upon mountains and rivers, but they made no other impress upon the continent from which time immemorial had been their dwelling place. The record of their past vanishes like one of their own forays into the wilderness. Their shell heaps and their graves are the only remains left to show that they once called these lands their own. They made no history. Currier's History of Newbury says exactly the same thing. And by the mid-1800s, Eastern Indians were presumed to no longer exist. Survivors certainly had no future, and even Indians came to believe it. Many chose not to speak their language, practice their traditions, or tell their children who they were. And what does that sound like? Sounds like a Holocaust. This is a 1905 history of Ipswich by Thomas Waters. He says that Indian history cannot be known but should not be ignored. And he even says that the Indians were men and women as ourselves, however rude or cruel. But we must try to construct their history as best we can. In the next paragraph, he goes on to claim that they practiced cannibalism on Treadwell Island, which is Perkins Island today. And in most other respects, his account resembles that of Robert Pringle, which is another historian of Gloucester. Now, in his history of Gloucester, Robert Pringle has two paragraphs on Indians, this one and one other that refers to artifacts and graves dug up here. In this one, note that he claims that the Indians deserted the area, not that they were driven out or otherwise discouraged from living here. The earliest town records contain few references to Indians. Even before John Endicott allocated the first house lots in Gloucester Plantation, the records suggest that there were no Indians here, when we see that there had to have been. And at the end of the 19th century, Pringle is simply repeating the claims made by the earlier historians in the absence of other intelligence. So you get this buildup of precedence, this certainty, so that today you can go into the Gloucester Archives or the Ipswich Library and be told that there were no Indians here. Now, John Wingate Thornton, writing in 1854, and John Babson, writing in 1860, Herbert Adams, writing in 1883, they do not mention Indians on Cape Ann. They describe how the Dorchester Company moved to Beverly-Salem and enjoyed the hospitality of the Indians there. But they were all Pawtucket under the Sagamore Ship of Masconomet. They were the same people. In his 1845 History of Salem, Joseph Felt says that earlier histories must be incorrect in claiming that the Indians were extinct prior to the establishment of the Mass Bay Colony, because there are accounts of them. But there is no word on what happened to them, except that collectors found Indian town full of bones, and that up to 1725, Indians visited Salem every year and camped on Gallows Hill. Here today, gone tomorrow, end of story. But Joseph Felt was regarded as an Indian lover, and even today, a historian is warned to take Joseph Felt with a grain of salt. In the oldest records I've been able to locate, the few land deals made on Cape Ann prior to 1638 are heavily redacted. They're blacked out. And it's possible that they recorded direct purchases of land from Indians, which the Mass Bay Colony made illegal in 1640. The old planters and the squatters lost their lands as a consequence, including, for example, William Jeffries, who lost Jeffries Neck, Jeffries Ledge in Ipswich, as well as Jeffries Creek in Manchester, which he had purchased directly from the Indians. This is how the old planters and the squatters lived prior to 1640. The Dorchester Company men had occupied Pawtucket wigwams in Fisherman's Field, And later they built these English wigwams. They used native materials. But they had a fireplace at one end instead of a smoke hole in the middle. And they had, you know, they made doorways. And this is how they lived, all the first dwellings in Ipswich, Salem Village, Cape Ann, Jeffrey's Creek, were adapted wigwams like these. In 1640, the Massachusetts Bay Colony announced that it was undesirable for Englishmen to live in wigwams. It was inconsistent with the modernization narrative, in which civilized people were supposed to be replacing primitive people. And in all the local town histories, you read about a spike in the building of plank and frame houses after 1640, between 1640 and 1650, is when all the first houses are recorded as having been built. Richard Dyke built a house on Wheeler Street. William Stevens built a house in Dogtown. William Allen built a house in Manchester, and so on. The extinction narrative, the wilderness narrative, and the replacement narrative were extended through beliefs about degeneracy. Indians stereotypically were devil worshippers and hostile to whites. Hostile is a stereotype. Their status as slaves, indentured servants, and debtors, wards of the state, subject to poverty and alcoholism, was proof of their degeneracy. And people claiming to be Indians could be denied their identity on the basis that they were not pure-blooded, or did not speak an Indian language, or no longer practiced Indian ways. And this was opposite to the one-drop rule that was applied to blacks, in which one drop of African blood made you black, whatever other blood you had in you. For Indians, one drop of white blood made you both black and no longer an Indian. The degeneracy model was and still is used to deny recognition and sovereignty to surviving groups. In this 1682 court case, this Indian is presumed to be naturally degenerate, and it spares him the death penalty. As a mere Indian, he couldn't possibly have understood that his rape of an English woman was wrong. A little hard to read English from the Stuart era period. People still apply the degeneracy model today. In 2004, the Department of the Interior revoked recognition of the Eastern Pequot, for example, on the grounds that they could not prove their descent. And observers at Massachusetts powwows today might question the Indianness of participants on the basis of their physical appearance or dress, which often is ethnographically incorrect, such as black Indians, descendants of Native Americans and African slaves, and descendants of Algonquians wearing, for example, Western Siouan regalia or costumes strictly from the imagination. So how can cultural authenticity be judged? Who is an Indian? The degeneracy model helped to justify the genocidal scalp hunting expeditions of the 1700s. This is the period that we don't hear much about, and this is why. This is an answer to the cloak of silence about Indians on Cape Ann. Only one person is named in the records as having enriched himself through scalp hunting, and that's Andrew Robinson. But you know, Andrew Robinson did not go scalp hunting in the boondocks all by himself. Look at the span of years in which bounties were paid for Indian scalps. An indignant letter written in 1775 said, here we are, it's 1775 and we still have Indian scalps hanging from the ceiling of our courthouse. So there's a pattern at the risk of overgeneralization. You have the first 100 years, the colonists admire the Indians, they're noble savages, and so on. Then the English became concerned that they might become savages themselves, and their derogatory views, like this one by Nathaniel Rogers, he refers to them as being slothful and unable to understand abstract truth, and so on. Then the Indians became the white man's enemy because of King Philip's War, and then the white man's burden as a conquered people. Then over the next 100 years, the narratives of erasure were written and acted upon. and in the 100 years following their extinction, the Indians were remembered, lionized, impersonated. Their image was rehabilitated. They became romantic heroes and victims in literature and in public art. And now, in the last 50 years, New England Indians have been rediscovered as not so vanished, after all. Politically active, intent on cultural preservation, and the reconstruction of remixed Native communities. And this is bringing the timeline into the 19th century after the War of Independence. The degeneracy narrative resurfaced to legitimate new Indian removal policies. The new argument was that Indians represented an obstacle to progress. Through their backwardness and economic dependency, they were impeding the growth of the United States. And I found it interesting that the last recorded return visits of previously displaced Pawtucket to ancestral sites on Cape Ann dated to the Indian Removal Act of 1830. And after the 1830s, here, as in other towns throughout our area, there's no mention of traditional Indian pilgrimages or summer visits, which had gone on for all that time. In 1892, William Cogswell spoke at a banquet on the 250th anniversary of Gloucester. He referred to Indians as obstacles to manifest destiny. He wrote, "This celebration means more than commercial prosperity and supremacy. It means, with the disadvantages of a hard climate, a sterile soil, and the hostile Indian, the overcoming of these obstacles, the breaking away from colonial dependence on Great Britain, and the successful establishment of a new country, then unconquered and unexplored, which today extends from ocean to ocean," and so on. It's the American story. William Cogswell's ancestor was granted 300 acres in Essex in 1636, where he built this house. But Cogswell's grant today and its museum do not mention Indians. This land is the site of ongoing archaeological excavations conducted this very day by the Massachusetts Historical Commission, revealing a long and rich history of Native occupation over 8,000 years. But those finds are not made public for fear of looting and desecration, with the result that the public does not know and thinks, oh, well, it must be true that there were no Indians here, so we're not hearing about it. This 250th celebration, in addition to speeches like Cogswell, there was a parade, and in the parade was a horse-drawn float developed by the self-styled historian Robert Pringle, with selectmen dressed as Puritans and Indians. One plays the role of Samuel English, Masconomet's grandson, signing over the deed to Gloucester. In the New England colonies, deeds signed by Indians were essential proofs of the colonists' legitimacy in taking over the land. They prided themselves on operating by rule of law. And most town histories in New England begin with the quitclaim deed that was signed by an Indian, and all the local Sagamores and Saucoms. And if you go on the Salem Registry of Deeds website, you can see all their signatures and marks on all the deeds. Impersonating Indians and dressing up as Puritan Indians became fashionable by the turn of the 20th century. The history of Indian-English relations had become reduced to erasure and replacement narratives and iconic moments such as deed signings. Here's Masconomet selling Ipswich to John Winthrop in Jr. in 1638. This is Alan Pearsall's famous mural. By 1658, when Masconomet died, the few Native families who had not relocated themselves were wards of the towns, or they were taken in as indentured servants or sold into slavery, or they were in Wemeset, their winter village, which had become a Christianized praying Indian town on the English frontier. Cape Ann colonial families owned Native American and African slaves. Some Pawtucket attached themselves or their children to colonial families as indentured servants for protection and to learn a trade. They became blacksmiths, shoemakers, barrel makers, shipbuilders, seamen, whalers. In Old Newbury, Great Tom attempted to assimilate by fencing 30 acres of farmland and keeping livestock. But in 1650, he sold his farm to the colonists and indentured himself, his wife, and children to two local colonial families. Even into the 20th century, itinerant families made a living selling baskets, brooms, and herbal remedies to colonial families. This is Santu Tony on the right, and her son, daughter-in-law, and grandchild. They were an itinerant family who came to an ancestral area in Riverview, where they were interviewed by the ethnologist Frank Speck prior to 1918. Between Nova Scotia and Cape Ann in the summers, they went dock to dock in a skiff, selling herbs, folk remedies, baskets, and brooms they made over the winters. These are the descendants of the people who lived here. Also in the late 19th century, the I.O., the bicentennial celebrations included speeches in honor of somebody identified as the last Indian. In the 1890s, Zerviah Gould Mitchell of Lakeville was billed as the last of the Wampanoags, for example. This was very interesting because, despite the fact that A, she was not a Wampanoag, and B, she had two daughters with living descendants today. Her designation as the last had to do with the concept of racial purity. And to be authentically Indian, you had to be pure-blooded. And believing there were no more pure-blooded Indians left east of the Appalachians, New Englanders developed a nostalgic, romantic craze for them. We got Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's Hiawatha. We got Last of the Mohicans by James Fenimore Cooper. Poems were written by John Greenleaf Whittier. Henry David Thoreau canoed up the Merrimack. Monuments were erected in town parks throughout the Northeast in memory of famous Indians such as Uncas, Canonicus, Miantonomo, Masconomet, Samoset, Squanto, Massasoit. Statues of Massasoit stand in 12 towns in New England. In Gloucester, there is a community between the Cut and Little River known as Winneadon. It was developed as a summer colony in the 1890s. Winneadon, by the way, is a Pawtucket word. It translates as in the vicinity of the heights. That community commemorates these famous chieftains in its street names. There's even a King Philip Road. The International Order of Red Men spread as a fraternal organization and secret society for white men. Their stated intentions were to preserve the beliefs and values of the vanished Indian and his way of life. It involved organizing as a tribe, meeting at council fires, and dressing up as Indians. Until recently, Indians, blacks, people of mixed race, immigrants, and the unemployed were not allowed to join, and certainly not women, until fairly recently. The Red Men were active on Cape Ann. I remember them in parades when I was a child. Do you? Some of you will remember them. They would wear black wigs and loincloths, which is very exciting, and they would carry tomahawks, and they would make war whoops. They would prowl on the fringes of parades and menace the onlookers, pretending to scalp boys, take pretty girls captive and make them march in the parade for a while, and then release them back into the crowd. The IORM movement did not wane until the 1950s as the AIM, or American Indian Movement, got underway. Wingersheek Tribe Number 12 of the Gloucester Improved Order of Red Men was not officially disbanded until 2009. 2009.
That's on the corner of
Redmen's Hall.
Redmen's Hall, above where Tompkins Furniture is.
But all during this time, the Indians have been here, undeclared, silent, invisible, through adaptation, assimilation, periodic relocation and return, strategic isolation. Native Americans still visit and protect sacred places here in Essex County, such as Masconomet's English grave in Hamilton.
I'm okay, thank you very much.
There are a lot of other Native American sites, and many Native Americans still come secretly to ancient landmarks and sacred sites here, such as this entrance to an ancestral village in Annisquam. And you can notice the petroglyphs on the intentionally split boulder on the right. And this is just, there's, you know, I could do a whole slideshow just on sacred landscape here.
Where's this right here?
It's near the entrance to Annisquam.
The entrance to Annisquam?
Yeah.
Leonard Street? Or
yes, right, it's on Leonard Street.
Where this rock is right here to the left?
I don't want to say the specific address because somebody might go and chip off that petroglyph. So
okay,
we just can't.
I understand. I was just curious. Thanks.
Where did our Pawtucket go? Well, some went to their relatives in praying Indian towns, which were intended to protect Native Americans by making them modern. They were going to be Christian. They were going to wear clothes. They were going to have permanent houses. They were going to have fences around their farms, and this was going to save them. Some well-intentioned people like Daniel Gookin and John Elliott tried to preserve Native Americans in this way. These villages also served as buffers against Dutch interests and the French and their Indian allies. The Pawtucket of Essex County, the Massachusetts of Middlesex County, and the Nipmuc of Worcester County were allied with a great Penacook sachem by the name of Passaconaway, whose real name was Papisaconawa, and his son Wanalancet, and they maintained strict neutrality. Most, but not all, Penacook did not participate in King Philip's War in 1675. But after it started, neutrality was impossible and nobody was safe. Any Cape Ann Pawtucket who stayed in Wamisit or Neshoba were attacked in their wigwams or escaped to the north. And any who went to relatives in Natick were rounded up and interred on Deer Island in Boston Harbor. After 1675, those who could fled to the boondocks. The praying Indian villages were attacked, and the Natick and others were confined on islands in Boston Harbor in winter without provisions. Maps from 1700 mark the entire seaboard as, quote, cleared of Indians, end of quote. In 1703, the Penacook and their allies, including our Pawtucket, were declared enemies of the state, and the Mass Bay Colony reissued bounties on Indian scalps. In 1722, bounties were offered for whole families, sparking scalp hunting expeditions in the boondocks to which the families had fled. In 1755, Massachusetts paid £40 for each male scalp, £20 for each female scalp, and £20 for the scalp of each child under the age of 12. In 1757, the price rose briefly to £300 per enemy scalp. This is state-sponsored genocide, and men from around here enriched themselves in service to the state. This was a real serious image problem for the English. They publicly prided themselves on not being savage-like or barbaric. They wanted to distinguish themselves from the Spanish with their inquisitions, which were going on at this time, and with their wholesale slaughter of the indigenous people in South America and Central America. How much easier just to have the Indians disappear? Whether by an act of God or by an act of nature or through their own bad judgment in going to war in the first place. And this, I think, is the real reason why erasure narratives have persisted in New England. How can the truth be told? But the New England Indians did not disappear. Survivors from King Philip's War and the scalp hunting expeditions were interned on reservations, or they were shipped to Bermuda or the Bahamas as slaves. These people are descendants of Penacook Indians who were shipwrecked in 1676 on their way to slavery in Bermuda, and they live on St. David's Island today. Where did the Pawtucket of Cape Ann go? Surviving Pawtucket, who had not managed to make themselves invisible in the general population, dispersed, visiting kin and undertaking pilgrimages to sacred locations. They returned to Cape Ann whenever the times were right and retreated again whenever they weren't, or learned to become invisible. Those at Wemyssit fled to the White Mountains and from there to join the Abenaki and the French Jesuits at St. Francis on the St. Lawrence River near Quebec, at Odenak and Becancourt, and they sided with the French in the French and Indian Wars. Here they are at Odenak around 1900. And here are some of their descendants at Odenak today. Some Pawtucket went to Vermont, to the Sokoke and Missisquoi at the headwaters of the Connecticut. These were their Western Abenaki allies against the Mohawks. And others went to the Pequaket above Lake Winnipesaukee and the Penobscot at Indian Island in Maine. Those were their Eastern Abenaki allies against the Mi'kmaq or the Tarentines. Western and Eastern Abenaki survived today. In the 20th century, some Abenaki groups, such as the Missisquoi of Vermont, perpetrated requirements for racial purity. They excluded individuals from their communities on that basis, and some tribes continue to discriminate among themselves today. These items are in the Penobscot Museum on Indian Island today. The Indian Council at Indian Island, when I asked if any families there had memories of ancestors who visited Cape Ann in the 1830s, I was told that their memories were short, and that the memories had to be short, and therefore I wasn't to ask. These baskets are the kind that the descendants of the Pawtucket brought from Penobscot by canoe to sell on Cape Ann in the summers throughout the 19th century. Santu Toni made baskets like those, and you probably have baskets like those in your family. Some Pawtucket accepted confinement on reservations, with Nipmuc at Hassanamisit in Grafton, or at Scaticook in New York, or with the Mohicans at Stockbridge, who were later removed as far west as Wisconsin. Others joined Abenaki war parties that fought the English for another 50 years in Casco Bay and in the Gulf of Maine. The Abenaki attacked the English attempting to settle in Maine, such as at New Gloucester, which was founded by farmers from here who petitioned for permission to move en masse to Maine. The Abenaki also killed or kidnapped and ransomed Cape Ann fishermen and their fishing vessels, earning reputations as pirates. Cape Ann sea captains such as Andrew Robinson became heroes as Indian fighters shipboard, and some Abenaki pirates and English sea captains alike became privateers in the War of Independence. But always there were descendants. Maskinomet had descendants, Nanapashamet had descendants, Passaconaway, Massasoit, Chickatobit, and the others, they all returned to where their ancestors were buried. Newspaper accounts tell of Pawtucket from Vermont visiting Gloucester during the 1800s. Pawtucket from Maine came in summers to Wheeler's Point in Riverview, Bent's Pasture in Annisquam, Pierce Island and Rust Island in the Annisquam. Visiting Pawtucket from Penobscot helped to put out Gloucester's Great Fire of 1830, and were later accused of having started it in order to curry favor by appearing to help put it out. There was just no way to win. This is Gladys Tantaquidgeon. She's the 10th generation descendant of Uncas, the Mohegan chieftain who fought on the side of the English in the Pequot War. On the left, she's with her brother. She died in 2005 at the age of 102. Descendants still come here, and they are among us, or they are us, even if we don't know who they are, even if they don't know who they are, even if we don't know who we are. Native Americans in Essex County intermarried and intermixed with the English and the French and took their surnames. They also intermarried and intermixed with African slaves and took the names of their masters. Some took names that identified them as friendlies to colonists. Others converted colonists' personal names for them to surnames, changing first names to last names. My one Native American ancestor was a Mohawk referred to as Squaw Mary on her marriage certificate. She married a Hemingway, an ancestor on my mother's side. Many of you have one or more Native American ancestors, whether you know it or not. This chart shows the number of individuals who reported themselves as American Indian on the 2010 census in towns around here. and these figures do not include those who marked more than one race, including American Indian. So taken at face value and ignoring sampling errors, the number of people with Native American ancestry is actually probably much higher. It's also likely that many of them are descendants of the Pawtucket, who lived in Agawam, Wenasquam, and Namkeag during the contact period, as well as Penacook, Mohawk, Mohican, Natick, Massachusetts, Nikmuk, Mi'kmaq, African, and whatever, others with whom they shared internment at one time or another. In the 2010 census, more than 18,000 people in Massachusetts identified themselves as Native American. These names are among the top 200 Native American surnames in New England, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Do you recognize any of these names? Here's some more that are among the top 200 Native American names in New England. So they did not become extinct. They persisted. Families integrated, adapted, picking and choosing what to keep and what to throw away. They found new ways to make a living. Some chose to forge new Native communities. They fought for their land and sacred places. They fought for their rights as Americans, which was some doing. Many of them revived their languages and arts and created other cultures that are new and different, remixed, but every bit is authentic because this is how we make ourselves as humans. In a very large sense, they are us. Michel Rolfe Trio, a Haitian anthropologist, wrote, "Historical narratives are premised on previous understandings, which are themselves premised on the distribution of archival power." So can Cape Ann change its story in the face of such archival power? As different as our ancestral ways of life were, and as difficult as our histories of contact have been, as unequal our relations have been, and as much as our memories have been erased, have we come to a time when we can get the story straight, and can we tell it to our children? And can we recognize and celebrate a shared heritage, make it visible, and preserve it for all time? Thank you.
Take questions from people. I'm sure there are
sure.
A lot of folks.
Or people have something to contribute, by all means. Yo,
yes. Very well researched. When is the book coming out?
Oh, I have to get back to the book. I have one. I have it in draft form, and I'm in the process of revising it.
Well, I hope you write it.
Thank you.
Well, that'll help. I'll have to spread it.
Yeah.
So you're saying that there are currently being excavated sites, Native American sites here, but people don't want you to know where they are because they're afraid they're going to be desecrated further.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't it in some way that contribute to the erasure?
Yes, it does. It's an ironic thing. It's two equally opposed forces that both have value or validity. And how do you merge them? How do you
protect it?
Well, they can. It's just that then you have to have an infrastructure. You have to have management. You have to have people to police an area. You have to have laws to punish people who do wrong in an area that's being protected. And a lot of communities don't want to invest. You need money to do that. You need personnel and so on.
We'd rather fix our sewers or something.
Yeah.
And who's the private people that are doing this? You said private.
Well, it's private properties, or you know, they're building. There's a law in Massachusetts: if you dig and you come to human bones, you have to stop.
Mm-hmm.
If you come to artifacts, most people stop if they're recognizable artifacts, and the state comes in to examine the material, and there are ways of repatriating the bones or the objects. So that they're dealt with properly and preserved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of an honor system if the developers has a conscience.
Absolutely, and in places like Annisquam, the contractors just throw everything back in and cover it over, build on top. Don't tell anybody.
There's a question here.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question.
Yes.
Did the Native Americans around here have like face paint?
Yeah, they did. They got the material for their face paint right here on Cape Ann. They got kaolin, which is made white paint, and they got ochre, which made red paint, and they got graphite, which made black paint. Those were their three favorite colors. Yeah.
They had pokun too, which is the bloodroot.
Ah, okay.
And the girls put a little red on their cheeks, red spots.
Okay.
And use that for dye, too, plus medicine.
Those are vegetable dyes.
Yeah, and it's also medicinal, too.
Right.
Can I mention something about paint for the little girl?
Sure.
Probably every native group all over the world used paint for decoration. And what we know about the people who lived here in this area, we don't know too much about that. Maybe historically, Mary Ellen could contribute to that. But historically, like the Lakota people, the Sioux people out in the prairie who hunted the buffalo, okay? The men who, when they went to war, they went out of the village and then put paint on so that the spirit wouldn't recognize their soul, their spirit, because they would be doing something wrong by killing some other person. So before they came back into the village, their village, they went to the stream and washed the paint off, and washed that off.
For historical evidence of paint use here, in 1686, Native Americans were mourning the loss of a great leader. May actually have been Daniel Gookin, who died that year and was a great protector of the Indians, but. It's written how they wore black face paint as a sign of mourning across the eyes. Is there any
question? So the Peabody Essex Museum has a collection of indigenous artifacts, and because, and rightly so, because of the Graves Protection Repatriation Act, you know, a lot of sacred artifacts went back to indigenous groups.
Mm-hmm.
So have you been able, I mean, do they keep aware of lists or photographs of those artifacts that would be of a sacred nature that you could have, that would help you in identifying more so the culture and practices around here?
To some extent, but it's the tribal councils are very protective of all that material and often don't want to share either the material or information about anything. It's like preserving private cultural content, which is too bad and understandable, but too bad. And of course, us anthropologists are awful for going in there and getting that information and often misusing it. But the Peabody Essex Museum, it's very difficult. I actually am going there on Tuesday to view collections from Cape Ann, and it has taken me over a year to get permission to see them. So,
it sounds like Annisquam seemed as if it were a center for ritual practices. And
very definitely, yep.
Yeah.
I have a colleague and I have just written a paper on Sunset Hill as a native solar observatory. It's going to be published in spring 2015.
Where's Sunset Hill?
Poles Hill. It's above Riverview. Riverview was the location of a Native village, the largest one on Cape Ann was there. And the hill above it, which is a rock outcrop, has been tested as an astronomical observatory. And we're getting very good feedback on it, so it maybe will prove to be true. So. Yeah.
This has been very, very enlightening. Thank you. One of the reasons I came was when we moved to the house we're in now in Rockport about 10 years ago, the lady who sold us the house said, there were all these shells around. She said, we think maybe someone was making clam chowder here and selling it. So I'm looking, and these, they're not clam shells, they're oyster shells. And they keep coming up from the ground. So I thought, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. So I started hanging around the Cape Ann Museum. Is that what it's called, the Rockport?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get anywhere. I can't find out what happened there. And but I learned a lot about the Agawam Indians and how very gentle they were.
And the Agawam and the Pawtucket were the same people.
Yes. Mm. And if I may share something personal, that's very sad, but I don't mean to make anyone sad here, okay? I have a son who died. He was in an automobile accident in Rockport, and he was a kid who loved the outdoors, and he camped, and he liked to go into the woods and everything. And right where his vehicle crashed and where he died, this is tremendous comfort to me. Nobody else was hurt, just him. There's a sign, which I'm sure Mary Ellen is very aware of, and it says, Samuel D. Champlain. I think Captain Smith sent him along and said, come on, check out that land. So he as you said, at Whale Cove, it's Whale Cove area. And he landed his boat, and he came ashore, and the Indians saw him, and they were so happy. And when he came, right where my son died, they danced.
I saw that song.
So
it's
so beautiful. But anyway, I was just very touched by what a gentle people they were. So hanging around that museum in Rockport, I did talk to different people. There were some people who are helping file things there are very elderly, and they have stories about what their relatives have said about the Agawams. So it's interesting.
My own view on that is that words like gentle are freighted terms, and they're similar to words like warlike.
Mm-hmm.
They're stereotypical. People are people, and the Native Americans were just as much perpetrators of brutality as the colonists were. To me, in my study of the history that's gone on, there really are no good guys and bad guys in the story at all. It ends up being, there are victims. There are innocent victims on both sides. Always it ends up being elderly and infants first, then children, then women. But, you know, as in any war conflict or genocidal type of situation. But I don't think we can characterize people, a whole people, as being good or bad or gentle or warlike.
I just considered them less hostile before. But they hadn't been burned yet.
They certainly worked very hard at trying to maintain neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
They needed the English for protection from their enemies, and also for all the riches that the English were bringing to them.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask one more question?
Yes.
What's with this scalping business? We always, when we were kids in the movies we saw, it was always the Indians that did all the scalping. Who started this scalping?
Right? The English.
the white people actually started the scalping?
I'm not sure that they started it, but they certainly practiced it.
The whites initiated the scalping of many tribes. And I find that rather disgusting.
Yeah, sure is.
Well, scalping was part of the warrior cult. One of the men's hairstyle included having a scalp lock, which is what, if you were killed in battle, your enemy was supposed to be able to get your scalp fairly easily. So it was like a challenge to make a scalp lock, and collecting coup and displaying them on poles was an Algonquian practice. I think it was more common in
Western. Yeah.
Well, Chesapeake Bay. They were Algonquians,
mm-hmm.
and they had scalp poles also.
Coustics.
So, coustics,
yeah.
Right.
Iroquoian. This must have been an English practice, too. I mean, if the state was paying Englishmen to
Yeah, the English did it. The English did it, too, definitely. I'm not sure they originated it.
Mm.
The English were all for beheading. Beheading was the thing to do it if you were English. The Europeans in general, English and the French, beheaded.
Mm.
a Native American scalp. Both groups were capable of great brutality. You can't pin it on any one group. I don't want to go into detail. Jill, if you are interested in that, read Jill Lepore's book, The Name of War, in which she explains what the people did to each other.
Mm. Well, that's where the name Mohawk, I think, the...
Man-eater.
Liver-eater, yeah.
Yeah.
It was Algonquin for liver-eater. So the warriors would take a little nip of the liver of the one they kill.
Yeah.
So growing up here, I was always told, you'll be told there weren't Indians here, but there were Indians here.
Oh, good.
And I don't have, because of my own personal history, I don't have access to where my stories came from. I don't have details or anything, but have you put a call out to get people's stories of their own family histories?
No, I haven't.
Because that seems like a great way. I mean, I don't, my mother would tell me stories about finding things and, growing up in Asquam and finding things. And there were walks we took as children. We would go near Folly Cove and look in caves there and all sorts of places. And, I would love there to be more stories. I don't remember them.
I would, too. I think that's a great idea, Amanda. I hear them when I give a talk like this, because people will come to me, come up afterwards and tell me, we have Native Americans in our ancestry, or, this, or we found this artifact here, or there's a site there. Some people have actually invited me to their properties to view things that they think are Native American sites.
It might be worth putting a call out.
How would you do that?
I would do it through the KBAN online forum and through Good Morning Gloucester and just ask for people to tell you their stories.
Good idea. How would you like to do that?
That's her idea.
You want to come to an open mic? That'd be great. Monday. Tell your Native American stories.
I think that's a great idea.
One more thing, Marilyn. The story I always remember about white men dressing up as Indians was the Boston Tea Party. Didn't the Masonic Lodge all dress up as Indians and throw the tea in the harbor?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There were famous plays that were put on Broadway, almost like vaudeville, featuring chieftains who would lament the demise of Indians.
Should we break up sort of informally, and then if people have more questions of Mary Ellen, they can ask? Thank you.